We're continuing in our series in the book of Daniel. So Ben is going to come and read Daniel chapter 12 for us.
At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, "How long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled?" The man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, "It will be for a time, times, and a half time. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed." I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, "My Lord, what will the outcome of all this be?" He replied, "Go your way, Daniel, because the words are rolled up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance."
Thanks very much, Ben. Can I just add my welcome to you if you're visiting here, and especially for those who are visiting from Hong Kong. It's really lovely to have you with us this morning. This is the last in a series in Daniel, and we found in the second half of Daniel it's quite tricky to understand, so I'm just going to pray again and ask for God's help as we spend some time looking at it. Father God, thank you that you inspired these words. Thank you that they're for our good. Thank you that Daniel teaches us something about how to live for you today. Please would you help us to receive your word this morning, to understand what you're saying. Amen. Lots of people are looking for the secrets hidden behind what's presented to us. So scientists search for the biology and the chemistry and the physics that we don't yet know, going down to the seafloor or putting telescopes in space to see distant galaxies. And then they try and figure out the laws behind those physical realities. Economists and sociologists seek the hidden forces and laws that shape societies. People want to know the secrets. Perhaps they want to know the sort of the hack code that will make life work better. Or perhaps they're looking for the conspiracy theory that will make sense of the craziness of this world. And the second half of Daniel is weird visions that God gives Daniel to reveal the spiritual realities of the world. And yet, there's something quite peculiar as we've gone through, particularly chapters 8 to 11, is that Daniel gets these visions and he's not very encouraged by them. He's shattered by them. He's disappointed almost. Because he gets to find out the spiritual realities behind the world. He finds out that God is working out a plan that will take centuries. And I think the problem for Daniel is this: a happy ending hundreds of years in the future doesn't help me. If I'm dead and everyone I love is dead, what use is the happy ending? It's no good learning the secret behind reality if I don't benefit from it. So Daniel, the book of Daniel ends with some amazing news as we get to chapter 12, the encouragement. Chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. And again, we're getting that sense of there's a long history. And then at the end of a long history, there'll be some terrible persecution and disasters for God's people. But in the end, God's forces will act and win. The spiritual forces of good, Michael and his angels, will win the battle. All of God's people, Daniel's people, will be delivered. Everyone whose name is written in God's book of life will be rescued and brought to share in God's kingdom forever. But again, it's not very encouraging for Daniel. And it strikes me as it's a little bit like that film, The Day After Tomorrow. I don't know if any of you like disaster movies. It sort of really took it to the max, because after a film in which hundreds of millions of people have died in climate catastrophes, we're supposed to sort of end with a sort of uplifting note as a very small band of heroes we've been following are saved. And it just sort of feels a bit like, well, it's not really that good an ending, is it? Daniel is not really comforted by the fact that in the end, in centuries' time, there's going to be victory. But then the angel gives Daniel some good news for him. Verse 2. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And perhaps some of us don't feel how amazing that message is, because in our stories and our cinematic universes, people coming back from the dead is almost normal, partly because film studios like to reuse characters. But, you know, Aslan and Gandalf and Snow White and Anna from Frozen, and you just go on and on. So many characters from the stories we love come back, and we just kind of think, oh, yeah, there's some vague hope that death won't be the end. But when we go away from the stories and go back into everyday life, what do we find? Death is a final separation from which there's no coming back. That's what makes death so terrible. A precious person stops existing in this world, and we have no contact, no sign of a person continuing. That there is nothing in our everyday life to make us think that there's life beyond death. The words that God speaks to Adam when Adam first sins still echo painfully at funerals. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you'll return. And so if we just looked at the reality, that if we just look at what's around us, what we can see, that's the conclusion. Death is the end. And then God reveals reality to Daniel. And he says, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Human beings dying is not the end. There will be a day of resurrection when those who sleep in the dust will awake. And this language of resurrection, it's not just that your soul might escape, that the invisible part of you might escape this world. No, that was the Greek hope. Here God is saying, your bodies will sleep in the dust, and I will raise them up and reunite body and soul, so that you'll be a breathing, living body again. Death is not the end. And that means that God's victory in the distant future is good news for Daniel. It's not just an irrelevant sort of prophecy of hundreds of years' time. Daniel will get to benefit from it. All of God's people through history will be delivered. It's not just the ones who survive all the turmoil who'll be saved, but all of God's people through history will share in the perfected world that God's bringing. Because dying before the day that God brings in his kingdom doesn't disqualify you. God will raise up multitudes who sleep in the dust. In that sense, the end of the story matters to everyone, because everyone's going to be there. The promise of resurrection is amazingly good news. It's good news for Daniel. He will get to be there when God puts things right, when the Son of Man that Daniel has seen and heard about rules for the whole world and brings in God's perfect kingdom. He will get to live with a renewed body in a renewed world where all injustice and evil has been removed. It's good news for Daniel. He's an old man. He really wants a resurrection body. But it's good news for us. However long we live, death is going to come to each one of us. But death is not the end. However long human history continues, the end of the story is God putting everything right and raising us from the dust of the earth to life. Resurrection, God raising human beings from death to life, is wonderfully good news. And I guess the skeptic then says, well, it's just pie in the sky. It's just a fairy tale that people tell themselves because they can't face up to the realities of death. What evidence is there that God will wake up to life multitudes who've been buried in the dust and have rotted away? Well, part of the evidence is the book of Daniel itself. Daniel has made prophecies that have come true already, so we can trust this additional one. Daniel has seen and prophesied that Babylon is going to be conquered by Persia, which has already happened. And then Persia is going to be conquered by Greece, which happened under Alexander the Great. And then split into four kingdoms, which happened when he died. And then a king from those, who we know now as Antiochus Epiphanes, tried to crush the Jewish faith. And then after the Greek Empire, there was the Roman Empire. And in the time of the Roman Empire, God's kingdom did start in this world in a new way as Jesus was born and died to bring forgiveness for sins. The Anointed One was cut off and killed to bring in forgiveness. There are a lot of fulfilled prophecies in Daniel over hundreds of years that give us some confidence that this future promise of resurrection is real. God will raise people from death, which means that we have a better hope than just a comfortable life and a hopefully painless death. We can have a hope of living forever in a world made perfect. And so what God does is he says, I really want you to know this is true. Seal up this prophecy. Verse 4. You, Daniel, roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. So they didn't have books then. They had long strips of writing material, and they rolled it up, and then they put a seal on it. And someone asked a couple of weeks ago, what use is a prophecy that's sealed up? How do you read it? So one of the commentaries I was checking this week had a helpful parallel in Jeremiah 32. In Jeremiah 32 and verse 10, Jeremiah is buying a field. He signs and seals the deed, had it witnessed, and weighed out the silver on the scales. I took the deed of purchase, the sealed copy containing the terms and conditions, as well as the unsealed copy, and I gave this deed to Baruch, son of Neriah. So Jeremiah is buying a field, and it seems that there's a sealed and an unsealed copy. So you can read all the terms and conditions in the unsealed copy. It's unrolled. But if you think someone's tampered with the terms and conditions on the open bit, you can then crack open the sealed one to check that it's still the same. It's a way of guaranteeing that it hasn't been changed. And what God's saying about the resurrection is, I want you to know that it's absolutely certain. Seal it up. It's like it's guaranteed not to change. But perhaps you say, well, the book of Daniel is a really old book, and I'm not really convinced by that either. The resurrection is a really big idea. I want something more. And actually, we know that dead bodies stay dead. So what do we look to find our ultimate confidence in the resurrection? The New Testament says, not really actually go back to Daniel, the New Testament says go to Jesus. Jesus was executed by the Romans. Pontius Pilate was the governor who had him killed. And we know that not just from the Gospels, though they are eyewitness accounts, but also from Roman historians. For example, Pontius Pilate was recorded by Tacitus as the one who killed him. So Tacitus writes in the 2nd century, but he has access to the Roman imperial archives, and he says, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, that's where Christianity comes from, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So we're definitely not in the realm of fairy tales here. We're in the realm of history. Jesus, who described himself as the Son of Man who would come in glory, was executed by the Romans. His body was put in a tomb. It seemed the story was over. He was not the rescuing king because he died. And then he rose from death. His was the first resurrection, the first really dead person to be made alive, never to die again. Tacitus doesn't quite mention that. He just says the superstition was briefly crushed, but soon broke out again in Judea. But the eyewitness accounts, the Gospels, tell us of an empty tomb, a missing body, and people meeting the risen Jesus. There's historical evidence that can be weighed. Something had to happen to make this group of monotheistic Jews worship a crucified man as God. The Jews, who over the preceding centuries had shown themselves willing to die, resisting the idolatry of Babylon and Persia, and of the wicked Antiochus Epiphanes, who tried to make them Greek and stop worshipping the Jewish God. They died in huge numbers to resist idolatry. They're renowned for only worshipping their God, the one God, they said. But after Jesus was crucified, a bunch of Jewish followers of Jesus start worshipping Jesus and are even being killed because they worship him as God. It must have taken something extraordinary. Something happened to make them say, Jesus is King, Jesus is God. And the only thing that really makes sense to me is that Jesus rose from the dead. They saw him, and so they knew he was the King promised, the Son of Man that Daniel saw, the one who will rule all of history. And if Jesus rose from death, then his promise to us, that multitudes who sleep in the dust will rise, is also true. And that's wonderful hope for frail human beings who could die any day. This is wonderful news for people who long for a happy ending and yet face death. So there's amazingly good news of the resurrection. But unfortunately, before we get there, there's some bad news. The frustratingly bad news is that there's tribulation or distress. So the angel says there's going to be a time of intense suffering before God wins, before he raises humanity. Chapter 12 and verse 1 again. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. There's a time of disaster and distress coming. And Daniel wants to know how long is it going to last. And he gets told 3.5 years or 1,290 days. A figure which keeps turning up in this book of Daniel. So verse 5, Daniel looked, and there before me stood two angels, one on this bank of the river, one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? The man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven, and I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time or a year, times or years, and half a time. So it's one time, 1 year, 2 years, and half a year, I think is what is being said. When the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be complete. And that's roughly the same as the 1,290 days of verse 11. And in that time, it will look like God's people have lost. The holy people have lost. They've been broken. And only after God's people look like they've failed will God's victory come. And so the big question for us is, when is this really bad time? If you're a follower of Jesus, you want to know, am I to expect this or has it already happened? If you're looking into Christianity, you might think, I kind of want to know the timing of this suffering. And there's basically three options, I think, that you could go with. One is that it's linked to the destruction of Rome, of Jerusalem in AD 70. So shortly after Jesus' death and resurrection, a few decades later, there's a Jewish rebellion against Rome. And at that time, the Jews, who after all are God's Old Testament covenant people, they are his holy people, they suffer intensely in that war. And at the end of it, the temple is destroyed. And now there is no temple. And there has never been rebuilt. There are no daily sacrifices as the Old Testament required. So maybe that's the 3.5 years that it's talking about, the siege of Jerusalem, which is certainly a terrible event. Another option is that this 3.5 years is a sort of symbolic period for a time that will be finished, a limited time. And so it's all of the time between the first and second coming of Jesus. We should expect trouble and distress as part of living in between the first and second coming of Jesus. Maybe. And the third option is there will be probably a literal 3.5 years of really bad persecution and evil in the world before Jesus comes back. And all of those are possible. And all of them have some biblical reasons to support them. But I'm just going to jump back to the end of Daniel 11. Last week we were covering Daniel 10 and 11, and I focused on Daniel 10. At the end of Daniel 11, it's like Daniel sort of gets a vision that slips off into the distant future. He's been looking at Antiochus Epiphanes, this tyrant from the 2nd century BC who had oppressed God's people in Jerusalem. And then at the end, it starts to talk about a king who doesn't really sound like Antiochus. He sounds like a wicked king made worse and bigger. So from chapter 11 and verse 36, you have this king who will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He'll be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his ancestors. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. And that just doesn't really fit Antiochus. So there's this sort of, you've got this forward-looking vision, you get to this oppressor of the Jews in the 2nd century BC, but then you get this king who is just worse and more successful. Antiochus didn't dishonor the gods of his ancestors in this way. He didn't win all his battles. And so I think Antiochus becomes a picture of a final bad king, in a bit the same way that a good king in the Bible, like David, is a picture of the good king to come, Jesus. And so, much to my surprise, I find myself thinking that actually Daniel is predicting a final period of intense suffering just before Jesus comes back. In general, as I've read the New Testament and Revelation, I've focused on this sort of the ongoing pattern, the idea that all through history there'll be opponents of Christianity. They will keep being enemies of God's people, like a drumbeat through history. And that's certainly true. Antiochus Epiphanes and Nero and Diocletian and Stalin and Mao, there have been no shortage of enemies of God's people who have persecuted Christians. Even today, there are people who make life hard for Christians. But I think Daniel's frustratingly bad news is that there could be worse to come. That for those who are God's people, we shouldn't be surprised if at some point there is a period of intense persecution before Jesus comes back. God is going to win in the end. The resurrection is good news. The journey might not be easy. And there is no promise in the Bible that those who are God's people will live lives of prosperous peace. That's not the news we'd like. That's really bad news. But it's helpful to have reality. We're not promised an easy journey. We should actually expect there to be, at some point, some persecution, some suffering. But there is the good news of the resurrection. And what should we do now? Well, we might think if there's going to be a period of suffering, of tribulation to come, the thing to do now is to keep your head down and wait till just after that period of suffering and then become a Christian. Time it just right. That's what you might think. But Daniel's vision actually says your choice now is what matters. Your choice now affects eternity. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth, verse 2, will awake. Some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And that's really important. Everyone gets resurrected, but not everyone enjoys eternal life and resurrection. Some rise to everlasting life, life with God, life to the full. But others rise to shame and everlasting contempt, rejected by God forever. All humanity rises. Not all humanity enjoys everlasting life with God, made right with God, and in a world where God is putting everything right. So what we do now really matters. What we do now impacts our eternity. That's the vitally important news, the vitally relevant news. Your choice affects your eternity. And I think verse 10 is particularly helpful to help us see this choice. Verse 10, many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. Two groups of people. And the default is, you can just continue on the path of fallen humanity. The wicked will continue to be wicked to the end. Humanity has rejected God. We're inclined to reject God as the good creator and the good ruler. And this wickedness, this rejecting our maker, the good lawgiver, trying to be the boss of our own lives, is why we make a mess of our lives and of our world. Some people live out this wickedness in very obviously wicked and selfish lives. They reject God and then they mistreat other people. And they obviously are selfish and unkind. Other people reject God and lead very respectable lives. They may even be quite helpful to other people a lot of the time. But if they're rejecting their maker, they're still living in the wicked way of humanity rejecting God. And here's the thing, this is the default. This is how human beings come into the world, and you don't have to do anything to continue on this path all the way to the shame and everlasting contempt that Daniel 12:2 warns of. You just continue rejecting God and trying to be boss of your life. But there's an alternative. You can choose now and wake to everlasting life. Because, verse 10, many will be purified, made spotless and refined. That's what God's plan does. In Daniel 9, the anointed one is put to death as part of God's plan to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness. Jesus came to be the sacrifice to purify God's people. Everyone's been wicked. Christians aren't those who are better and have never been wicked. No, everyone has been wicked. Everyone is stained with sin. Sin makes us unacceptable to God, so we all need to be cleansed, purified, made spotless. I guess we sometimes think of sin a bit like a minor blemish. It's a bit like a bit of furniture gets scratched, and if you just turn it around, no one will see the scratch. It doesn't really matter. But I think sin is something much more foul that contaminates whatever it comes into contact with. If there was some dog poo smeared on your salad, you wouldn't want to touch any of it. You would throw it away. And that's what our wickedness is like in relationship to God. Yes, there's lots of good in each of us, but the wickedness contaminates it. And until it's been washed away with something that's stronger than bleach, God doesn't want us. God will not have us. In love, God provides what will purify our sin. By transferring our sins to Jesus on the cross, Jesus experiences God's repulsion at our sin, our wickedness on the cross. God isn't repulsed by Jesus' sin. Jesus has no sin, but Jesus takes our sin on himself. And he experiences God's hatred of sin on the cross so that we never have to. And so now there is this choice. It's not automatic. Jesus dies to bring purification from evil, but it has to be received. It's a bit like if someone, you know, it's maybe a bit archaic now, but if someone hands you a check for a large sum of money, they've already said the money's there and I'm happy to give it to you, but you have to cash it. And so Jesus has paid the price. He says, what you have to do is receive me. Receive me as God's promised king, the anointed one, the one who rescues. And at that moment, the moment you welcome me as God and rescuer, you are purified of your sin and made right with God forever. And he then works to refine us and make us right in our hearts and behaviors, fitting us for eternal glory. But there's a choice. You have to choose to accept Jesus today. And there is no more important choice that you'll make. If you're thinking about this, or you're not a Christian, you're thinking about it, please speak to a Christian friend about how you can receive Jesus, or if you have questions you want to deal with before you get there, please ask those questions. Daniel tells us that this is the wise choice. It's the wise choice to fear God who made us, and the wise choice to receive God's kind rescue in Jesus. The choice you make now to receive Jesus and follow Jesus leads to eternal glory. Verse 3, those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. See, Daniel doesn't just get to sort of look through a telescope at a glory that's going to come, but he's never going to arrive at. He doesn't even just get to join the party. He will get to shine like the brightness of heaven there. His wise trust in God and faithfulness in exile will bring him eternal reward and glory. Daniel, in many ways, was a complete failure. He never led God's people to victory in battle. He never achieved freedom for God's people. He worked for a foreign empire, a pagan kingdom. He had to often compromise. He had to accept that he lived in a culture that worshipped other gods and that didn't want to follow God's law. But he stood firm in his fundamental loyalty to God. He kindly witnessed to his pagan colleagues and bosses. And so he's promised he will shine like the brightness of heaven when God puts everything right. Let me say, that's a great encouragement for me, and I hope it's a great encouragement for you. Because I may never be a Martin Luther who causes reformation across a continent. I may never be a John Wesley preaching and seeing thousands converted. I may never be a Wilberforce who ends slavery. You and I may live fairly ordinary lives in work and family and neighborhood. In a culture that by and large ignores God, and we may not see any great turning point of victory in our lifetimes. We might, but we might not. But if we fear God and trust Jesus, then we will shine like the heavens in the end. If we help each other to trust Jesus, to make us right with God, if we help people to find out about how they can be right with God through Jesus, then we will shine like the stars forever. Most of us won't achieve great things as the world measures it. Most of us will never get a knighthood or Wikipedia pages about us. But God knows us. And he sees our attempts to share the good news of Jesus, to live following Jesus, to help others to follow Jesus. And he will raise us up and make us shine like stars, to be glorious within a glorious new creation. And that's what makes it all worthwhile. That the wise choice to trust Jesus leads to eternal glory given by God. Daniel ends with this encouragement. For Daniel, he's not going to see in the flesh, in his lifetime, these long rise and fall of empires and the persecution of God's people or the coming of the Anointed One. But he will rise in glory at the end. Verse 13, as for you, go on your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. And that's the same encouragement that each of us needs in the face of death. I'm going to finish by reading some words from the funeral service, because I think that's the situation where we need this encouragement the most. In the face of death, let's listen to these words from the funeral service. We have entrusted our sister to God's mercy, and we now commit her body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our frail bodies, that they may be conformed to his glorious body, who died and was buried and rose again for us. To him be glory forever. And that's the hope the book of Daniel ends with. A hope that we see more fully because we see Jesus risen from the dead. And that is the hope that we still all need in the face of death. What I want to do now is to take a couple of minutes to reflect. It might be you're just visiting today, just to reflect on this particular passage, what's encouraged you or what's challenged you from this passage. But if you've been with us through the series, you might also want to reflect on things you've noticed through the sort of whole series of Daniel. So we've got time for a couple of minutes of reflecting. If you want to just do that by yourself, that's fine. But if you want to talk to the person next to you, that's also fine. Talk two or three together. What's encouraged you? What's challenged you? If you have any questions, I might have time to take a couple of questions. I can't promise to answer them, but I'm happy to take any if people have questions. So have a couple of minutes to talk with the person next to you or to think personally about what you've heard from this message of Daniel. That's obviously just a very short moment to begin thinking about it, but did anyone want to share any particular encouragements or challenges or any questions that they had? Mike? Yeah, so Mike was saying, in safeguarding or other things, you just see the mess of fallenness of the world, and there's no quick solutions. Daniel lived in the mess and yet was faithful to God, and that's the encouragement. Yeah. Janice. Yeah. God is enough for Daniel in exile, even if he doesn't get all his youthful ambitions. Yeah.